guys, and welcome back to Teens of Profiling. This is Unit 1, Lesson 2, and today we will be covering the basics of the first two steps to creating a profile. Thanks for all the love on the TikTok, and we currently have over 300 students. Crazy, right? I feel like we should make a big group chat and be friends or something. Anyway, on with the lesson. The process of developing a criminal profile usually happens in 6 stages. Like I said, we will only be covering the first two today, which are input and decision process models. The names can be a bit confusing to new ears, so let me explain. The input stage is exactly what you would think it would be. It begins with collecting as much information about the crime scene and case in question as possible. Basically, inputting all the information of the crime scene into the investigation and profile in progress. One thing that is very important in the input stage is the crime scene photographs, as they depict information such as body position, patterns of evidence, blood splatters, broken glass, anything like that. However, those things are usually analyzed by forensic psychiatrists, not criminal profilers. Details in photographs can reveal factors such as risk level, degree of control exhibited by the unsub, how experienced they might be, and their emotional state at the time of the crime. Another thing that is super important during the input stage is the complete history of the victim. For example, a case where all the victims have an extensive online history might be vastly different from a case where the victims can't be found online at all. A profiler will request information such as employment history, social habits, hobbies and interests, their reputation among friends, coworkers, and family, and even evidence of their fears. Other information such as autopsy photos, police and lab programs, and medical examiner's reports are also super helpful. We'll go through all of this in depth later, so remember, this is just an overview. Even though it seems like profilers need every bit of information about a suspect or victim, there are also some things that can't be included. Shocking, I know. For example, if a profiler has access to the files of a police suspect, they may experience confirmation bias, where they misinterpret the facts to support what they already believe is true. That's why profilers are only allowed to look at evidence that pertains directly to the crime, and they don't look at information about suspects before creating their profile. After the input stage comes the decision process model stage. The name is weird, I know, but it's kind of descriptive. In this stage, the profilers are making decisions to fit the crime to already existing models. That's how I like to remember it, at least. Once the profiler has gathered enough information in the input stage, the information must be organized and classified. Profilers take the information from input and look for recognizable patterns to compare and differentiate different parts of the crime and form a basic rough draft of a profile. The first step is classifying the crime. You know when Hotcha Reed will be like, the cooling off period is shortening, he's escalating, in like every episode where there's multiple murders? Yeah, that's this part. And yes, I did reference Criminal Minds again because let's be honest, we all watch it, and Matt Simmons is the best character. I know, controversial opinion, literally no one thinks that but me, but I said it. Anyway, back to the decision process model stage. A profiler may be involved in many crimes such as arson, burglary, terrorism, and homicide. If the crime is murder, it must be classified further. Because let's be honest, there is a difference between someone who kills once every 10 years and someone who kills 10 people in 2 days. Murder is classified by number of victims, number of locations, as well as the number of events and the period of time between. I'll admit it, I haven't fully memorized all the murder classifications yet, but I'll add a clear table to the Google Classroom for you to peruse, for fun, I guess. I'm just realizing that we like to peruse types of murder for fun. But if there are 3 victims at a single location at the same time, for example, and there's enough evidence to show that a single unsub committed all 3, the murder is then classified as a triple homicide. But if there are 3 victims at 3 different locations, and there's evidence to conclude that the same person committed all 3, the murder would be classified as a serial or spree murder, depending on the cooling off period of the unsub. Spree kills take place at more than one location with almost no cooling off period, while a serial killer takes days, months, or even years to cool off. In addition to being classified by type and style, there are 2 types of mass murder, class and family. Classic mass murder involves one person operating in one location at one period of time. Classic mass murder is usually a mental disordered person whose problems have increased so much that they act against groups of people unrelated to them or their problems. James Huberty is a good example. Well, okay, he wasn't good, but you know what I mean. James entered a fast food restaurant with a machine gun and killed many people due to his anger that was unrelated to anyone in the restaurant and unrelated to the restaurant itself. The second type of mass murder is family. If more than 3 family members are killed and the offender takes his own life, it is classified as a mass murder-suicide. If there is no suicide and 4 more family members are dead, it is classified as a family killing. John List is an example of this. He killed his entire family in 1972, left their bodies in the front room of the house lying side by side, and completely disappeared after the crime. His car was found in an airport parking lot. Creepy. Two other types of murder are serial and spree, but we covered those already. A serial murderer may eventually commit spree killings, however, and it may come as a surprise, but killers don't care what their crime is classified as. At all. Even though the killer doesn't care, it's important to classify homicide correctly. The correct classification will always assist in making an accurate profile. I mean, that probably speaks for itself, because someone who kills 10 people in one day is obviously different from someone who kills one and is never heard from again, you know? Now we'll briefly talk about the rest of the decision process model stage beyond classification, but we'll go more in depth about the rest of the stage in victimology episodes tomorrow. But for the sake of clarification, I'll introduce it now. Another thing that the profile will decide in the decision process model stage is the primary intent of the offender. In some cases, murder may be a forensic countermeasure and not the primary intent at all. The primary intent could be criminal enterprise, emotional needs, or sexual needs. I'll give an overview of all these. If the primary intent is criminal enterprise, the killer may be involved in crime for his livelihood. Murder is part of this unsub's business, and there really isn't any personal malice towards the victims. The primary motive in this case would be money. Examples of offenders include gang murders, competition murderers, and so on. When the primary intent involves emotional needs, the murderer may kill in self-defense or compassion, which is called a mercy killing. Family disputes may result in infanticide or spouse killings. Mentally disordered unsubs may commit a symbolic crime that is a manifestation of their anger or carry out assassinations of those who have caused them pain, or at least who they think have caused them pain. Finally, the murderer may have sexual motives for killing. We'll go super in-depth about this later, but sexually motivated unsubs usually kill to engage in sexual activity, mutilation, evisceration, or other events that have sexual meaning for the unsub. Next, you've probably heard the term high-risk and low-risk victims before, and it basically means, what risk is there that someone will become a victim? If someone is labeled as a high-risk victim, they might be unable to defend themselves in a dark place or a dangerous area in the city. Low-risk victims include those whose age, occupation, lifestyle, physical stature, and resistance ability does not make them likely to become a victim in most cases. Profilers use this to help figure out the aim of the unsub and what they will do next. Time factors are also important. As I mentioned before, how the unsub escalates is a big part of the crime and profile, but other factors are at play. These include the time it takes to kill the victim, commit additional acts with the body, and dispose of the body if the unsub chooses to do so. The time of day is important because it shows the preference of the unsub, which can therefore deduce things about their lifestyle, like when they work, things like that. For example, the longer an unsub stays with the victim, the riskier, because that ups the chances that they will be caught, so profilers must ask, why did they choose to stay? What meaning does this have for the unsub? Tomorrow, we will dive deeper into victimology. It will basically be a more in-depth version of the second half of this episode. If you're on our Google Classroom, there are some classifying crime practice posted. Also, I've decided not to grade any work, but I'm happy to provide written feedback on specific assignments if you wish. I kind of expected that I'd have 30 students, not 300, but I'm thankful for all of you, and I'm really happy that you're here. Thanks for listening, and I hope you learned something new.